December 9th, 1997, we're in Mesa. You've just executed the deed of form, meaning that you're wanting to do this.
Absolutely. Could we take just a little second to get some water? Something else.
All right, you got your water.
I got my water.
We got the preliminaries out of the way.
Yep.
Why don't you start telling me what the National Council La Raza is? What is that? Where did it begin? A little history.
Well, the National Council of La Raza is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that was founded in 1968 in Phoenix, I believe. It was the Southwest Council of La Raza. And then grew from there to become the National Council of La Raza. The headquarters are now in Washington, D.C. But it's a national civil rights organization with a mission to eliminate discrimination and poverty in Latino communities throughout the United States. And that's our focus. In the field offices, we focus more on working with community-based organizations, nonprofits, and our activities are more project-oriented to help communities build themselves.
How many field offices are there?
There are five. Chicago, Los Angeles, Phoenix, the East Coast offices in Washington, D.C., and then the Texas offices here in San Antonio.
Well, what does the council do to carry out this mission?
Well, to carry out our advocacy mission is mainly done, or has been done in Washington, D.C. at the national level. We have a national think tank on Latino issues, and we have an office of policy, legislation, and advocacy that works on the Hill to develop legislation to help the Latino community or to fight against legislation that's detrimental to the community. We're in a re-engineering mode right now because with devolution and decision-making and powers being forced down to the state and local level, then our shift on advocacy is going to have to change as well. And we're going to have to continue to do some of that national stuff, but also bring it down to the regional and local levels. And so that's going to be a big struggle for us, I think.
As a nonprofit, how can you get away with lobbying?
We actually have a budget for lobbying. We follow the IRS regulations that limit the amount of your total budget that can go into lobbying, and the money spent on lobbying is money that's raised primarily through MCLR fundraisers, which is our biggest one, is the annual conference, which occurs every July. And that money is discretionary money. It's our own money. It doesn't have the strings that tie to federal money or foundation money. So that's the money that we generally use for lobbying.
That's a big event, that convention. How much does it generate?
Oh, it differs, but I think it's up. I really don't know how much it generates. It's a significant portion. We have over 10,000 people go through the conference. I think this last year, which was in Chicago, we had a little over 10,000 participants that went through. Now, that's not paid registrants because the conference workshops are free. So people that pay the registration fee get to do the banquets and other stuff. But I'm sure it's well over $150,000, $200,000. That's a guess.
Okay.
I don't keep the books.
What other kind of funding does the National Council attract?
We get funding from the Ford Foundation. I think we get some core support money from the Ford Foundation.
Has that been the case since the beginning?
Since the beginning.
Never interrupted?
No. Ford has been a strong sponsor. But we have a diversity. Our own policies do not allow us to accept more than, I think it's 25% federal money. So we do have some DOL grants and some HUD grants. But most of the money comes from corporate sponsorship, foundations such as the Ford Foundation, and some program funds. Fannie Mae Corporation, we have a contract with them to do housing counseling in Latino communities. Casey Foundation, and there's just a variety of foundations and corporations, Prudential, Coca-Cola, big AT&T. So we have a significant corporate support as well.
Casey, how do you spell that, or is that two letters?
Casey, C-A-S-E-Y.
Oh, okay.
Foundation.
Did I hear you right saying that you have a self-imposed cap on government contracting at 24%?
I think it's about 20 to 25% that NCLR will not allow, we will not have more than 25% of our total budget be from federal funds. And that was a learning lesson. I wasn't here then, but I understand that in the 80s when we had, I guess, devolution, we had devolution in the 80s, a lot of federal money was lost and a lot of organizations closed. And NCLR went from, I think our staff was reduced to, you know, less than 30 as a result of loss of a lot of federal contracts. So from that time forward, the board decided that we should not be dependent on any particular source for a significant portion of the budget. And so then the board passed a policy limiting the amount of federal funds that would make up the total budget.
Is there a limit on the foundation side?
No.
Well, isn't that just as valid a danger or evil?
It is, but we don't count on it as much. I mean, for example, we get a 3-year contract to do housing counseling, then we are we are in fundraising mode all the time. So we know that if we develop this program that's going to be funded for 3 years and there's no guarantee after that third year, then from day one you start building in, number one, is this going to be a 3-year program and then that's it, it's going to go? Or is it something that we want to plan on continuing? And if we do, then will it can we do it where we generate some income out of it? Or who's going to fund it next? Or, you know, if we can prove certain levels or certain deliverables, then who would be interested in those deliverables and how can we move from there? So we're always anticipating what's going to happen next and who else we can get to fund that program. And sometimes the programs take on different scenarios than what they were originally planned for, and other funders become interested in it. But it's possible that the programs could have a specified lifespan and say, we're going to do this from this period to that period, and then the National Council will not be doing it anymore. Maybe affiliates take it over or something like that. So,
how many affiliates are there?
There are over 210 affiliates nationally. We have 36 in Texas.
What does the council at the headquarters in Washington or the regional office do for these affiliates?
Well, several things. Of course, we have the national advocacy going on for all Latinos, but our constituency is the community-based organizations. While we try to make sure that every program that we have and every activity that we do positively impacts Latino families, we do that through community-based organizations. We're generally not a direct service provider. So we provide technical assistance, we provide some monetary support for some of their programs, we provide capacity building training and activities for them. At the national level, through the advocacy portion in Washington, they get action alerts to respond to different issues. They get funding alerts that tell them that particular funding is available in certain areas, and we try to help them respond if they're interested in applying for some of that funding. So it's a support relationship.
These action alerts, do they respond?
Sometimes they do. What I have found is that if an action alert comes out from Washington, D.C. and is sent to a group, it generally sits on somebody's desk because, as Beto Lueta says, NCLR sends out a lot of mail, so he puts it on his to-read list. If it's something that we're particularly interested in here at this field office, or that we get a call from Washington saying this is a life-or-death kind of situation, then our staff here, the regional staff, will call the affiliates and try to get responses out. I don't know specifically what the percentage of responses are. I do know that when the AmeriCorps funding was in jeopardy, we got all of our affiliates, the 36 affiliates in Texas, most of them to respond. I think it was like 90% of them responded in a 45-minute period, making phone calls, sending telegrams and faxes, so that I think somebody told me that within 45 minutes, 150 NCLR employees had responded, affiliates had responded to that request.
How was the AmeriCorps an urgent priority?
A lot of our groups, a lot of our affiliates have AmeriCorps workers in their organizations that are doing it. For example, if you have emergency shelter care, that are providing some of that staff to client ratios for them that We have some that are running charter schools where the AmeriCorps workers are used as the teacher's aides. So it would have really impacted those groups that utilize those staff positions, because then they would actually be losing staff.
Does it ever flow from the bottom up? Like, for example, the killing of Ezequiel Hernandez on the border by the troops, or some of the other more immediate things that occur here in the community, the scandal in Dallas with the superintendent where the blacks were bashing the Hispanics?
We've done some of that. We haven't done a lot of that here. One of the major issues that, you know, we had here that came from the bottom up, and of course it's a national issue, but was the immigration issue and what happens, and people were getting letters, and, you know, how were we going to handle this? And that's something that that a lot of affiliates brought to our attention. The emergency food bank issue. We had affiliates on the border area, Laredo particularly, they called and said, there's such a huge number of people that are losing their food stamps. And then there's the run on the food bank, and the food bank was not prepared to handle that kind of stuff. Well, then, you know, they called my office, we called Washington, Raul was able to, through some of his contacts, get some more support for the food bank. But that was very limited. What we're trying to do is organize all the affiliates together so that as a group, they have more strength. But we have done that. We do some press releases. Sometimes it gets in our papers here, sometimes it doesn't, where the killing in Marfa, that little boy, that little high school boy, by the Marines, was a touchy issue. We issued press releases, not that our papers picked them up. We worked with some of the affiliates in El Paso to see what they wanted to do and how they wanted to address that issue. And there was a couple of rallies and stuff. We had called for our congressional leadership to check into what had happened there. I think we're still very disappointed in the way that whole thing has been handled. And I understand the family is now going to file a civil lawsuit, but you know, we try to do those things. One of the difficulties that we have, and I mean, and stuff like that, and the immigration issues, people being cut off of welfare, SSI, those are pretty much issues that everybody can agree on, you know, that we need to take a stand, and this is our stand. We have other issues that are, you know, not so life-threatening, but they're still issues. The charter school issue, where we do not have a consensus among the affiliates on whether that's a good idea or not. So what we do is those who are going into that business, we will provide them with the technical assistance and the support that they need. And those who are not involved in it or want to fight against it or oppose it, then they may do that. We haven't taken a stand one way or another because the affiliates haven't come together on it. So it's you know, we all operate as independent 501c3s. So we're going to have that difference of opinion.
But you do have this network. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
The affiliate network? Does each state have that?
No. The NCLR Texas Affiliate Network is the only one. When I came here, what Raul had told me was that there was a disconnection between affiliates and NCLR. So the first 3 months that I was here, I went around the state and I visited everybody. Just to meet with them once. And I was told, you know, I've been an affiliate for 25 years. This is the first time an NCLR staff person has come to my office. And it gave me a different perspective because I knew each one of them personally. I knew who the director was. I knew what their office operation was. I knew what they did. So that when they call me on the phone and say, I need help with this, I know what they're talking about. So we did that, and we formed this network, and they meet quarterly. And they discuss issues that they want to discuss. And we try to bring some resources to them so that they can either have experts working with them or whatever they want to discuss at these meetings. We are starting to develop the same model in other areas. I think California is trying to do it. Well, California used to be, the LA office used to have a bigger a geographic area that they covered. It was multi-state. Well, they've just been reduced to just the state of California now. So that would give that office director more opportunity to work just with those affiliates in California and try to organize them. this last legislative session here in Texas, we were able to go to committees at the legislature and testify on issues mostly dealing with affordable housing development. And we were successful in working with other coalitions like the Texas Association of CDCs in supporting some legislation that made it easier for nonprofits to do affordable housing. You know, that their properties that they purchase would remain tax exempt until they're sold and issues like that. So we had some minor successes at the legislature, and I think that was because they were organized. We were all together, we all supported it, and when we made a phone call, people would show up in Austin to address the issue. The other field offices, for example, the Midwest office in Chicago has 11 states. It's much more difficult for them to organize the way we have here. And I have to tell you that they try to give me Oklahoma, they try to give me some other states, but I've convinced Washington and Monroe that Texas is enough for us to handle and to deal with the affiliates here in Texas. And I think if we could keep this going and if we could really move the network into staying together and continuing the collaboration and stuff, then it's probably a model that we could take to other states. We have written up what we've done so far and just, you know, through agendas and minutes of meetings and send it to California so that they can try it there. This is a big state, and you know, just traveling around Texas takes a long time, much less, you know, having to work. And our groups are so diverse. We have healthcare providers, affordable housing development, educators, immigration services. So, you know, they run the gamut, and this office here tries to respond to as many of their needs as possible, which is kind of a little difficult because you can't be an expert in everything.
What's your annual budget to try to do all this?
Our annual budget out of this office is probably about $230,000,
$250,000. And the NCLR national office budget?
The national office budget, I think, is somewhere between $9 and $11 million.
I know that there's an extensive mailing program.
Right.
It just rains paper into the affiliates and others.
Right. If we could get everybody hooked up on email, we wouldn't have that problem.
Well, I was going to ask you about the efficacy of that as opposed to, say, faxes for the action alerts. I mean, if they think it's not urgent because it's mailed, would they now think it's urgent if you faxed it? Or do the affiliates not all have faxes?
Now all of our affiliates do have faxes. We had three or four that had not had fax machines, but now they're all connected on fax. Those who have email, which I think now is only two out of the 36 in Texas, will email. But what we're trying to do now is NCLR got a grant from NYNEX to connect all of our offices, our field offices, with the Washington office. And what we'd like to do now is to write a proposal to take that further down and to start to hook the affiliates into NCLR, which includes the hardware and the software. So in California, they did get a grant, a technology grant, and they are working on hooking up with all of their affiliates. Here, we'll probably write a proposal either to Southwestern Bell or Dell Computers or somebody to try and get that done for the affiliates here as well. So, but it's a fundraising issue. And constantly, it's always a resource issue. And then, of course, you have to keep everybody... we have a problem keeping ourselves constant in the various field offices on the same software and stuff. So you can imagine if you have 210 affiliates and trying to keep them on the same software. Some affiliates are mega organizations, Chicanos por la Causa, you know, whose budgets are bigger than NCLR's, you know. And so for them, you know, they're always in the latest and greatest technology mode. And so you're always having somebody lagging behind. Then you have affiliates who have zero budgets, and you know, so it's just a huge gap, and so trying to meet everybody's needs.
Which is the largest affiliate in terms of resources here in Texas?
Texas Migrant Council. Huge.
Based out of Laredo.
Laredo, right.
$49 what?
$40 million budget. migrant
history. The affiliates, of course, don't have the same cap on federal funds, no? Because that's basically all federal funds.
Right, that's all federal. No, they don't. Now, we did have some organizations that we're trying to work with them and encourage them to diversify their funding. For example, those who are 100% DOL funded are having a very, very difficult time.
Because that's the Project SER people?
Project SER, with Image, all of these groups, because that entire process and system of putting out money has changed, the Workforce Development Councils. And there's been a change in concept among those people that are running the workforce development programs, and that is that the community colleges are the places that should be providing these services as opposed to CBOs, community-based organizations. And that is a community fighting for a place for community-based organizations in the state of Texas is a full-time job. They're constantly trying to cut out CBOs. The Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs is recommending to their board that they not have set-asides for community-based organizations. They're also saying in those areas where community-based organizations have been the only applicants, they want to open it up to private developers, so that now CBOs will be competing with private developers. So we're constantly having to make sure that community-based organizations are written into new legislation, such as the charter schools, or that we're not cut out of legislation as time goes by. So it's a constant battle. In areas in the Midwest, in the Northeast, community-based organizations have a higher status than they do in Texas and in the Southwest. So it's a constant battle. And as Congressman Ruben Hinojosa told me, he says, we need to certify groups somehow, because the perception is that if you give money to a nonprofit, it's going to a black hole, and you don't expect to get anything back. So if you're going to give it, you're throwing it away, which is, we're moving all of the affiliates, and I think most of them are very, very good at being performance-based. And so that what we need to learn how to do is how to document what we do and then how to sell our story.
Well, that also is the other stream of paper that flows back, constant questionnaires and surveys and evaluation. Where is all that data? Does any of it stop here? Do you get reports back on the efficacy or capacity?
I went out and had everybody fill out an agency profile, which NCLR asked the affiliates to fill out. So, and we're trying to put that on the computer. But basically, I know what their annual budgets are. I know what kind of equipment they have in their office. I know what kind of staff they have. I know what programs they run. So where I have used some of that information is sometimes I'll get a call from a foundation or a bank or somebody that says, going to be the end of the year and I'm a little bit below my giving thresholds, and so I need to put some money out there, and I'm interested in somebody that is specifically working with early childhood education. Then I will just pull the information, because I have the IRS letters, I have the articles of incorporation, I have everything here, and I will put a request, a letter proposal to the bank or whoever, and say, we're requesting $5,000 or $2,500 for this organization, and here's all the backup work. Send it in, and they get these little checks. It's not a lot, but if it's available, we want to make sure that it gets to the right places. So we do some of that. Also, it's going to help us as we're looking at putting a proposal together to network everybody through the computers electronically. Then, gives us a sense of where people are. We know those who have absolutely no computers. We know people who have everything. So, it tells us where they are, what the state is. And then I try to update those every 2 years. But you're right. But the thing is how many surveys can people fill out? So a lot of times I just do it through telephone calls, and I, just ask them the questions and fill it out myself. It's easier that way.
These 30, how many affiliates in Texas?
36.
These 36, are they geographically specific into areas, or are they all over the state? Do you have a list and a map?
I have a list and a map that I can share.
Is that
share
public
with
information?
You. Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I can share that with you. I don't think the newest ones are on the map, but we can add them on. We have an affiliate in Lubbock. We have some in Dallas. Most of our affiliates are south. Well, we have El Paso, Houston. But, you know, we have a tremendous number of affiliates from San Antonio all the way to the valley, you know, along the border.
That's what I was going to ask. Anything in East Texas at all?
No.
Past Lubbock into the Panhandle?
No.
North of Dallas into that Wichita Falls, Sherman, Denison area?
Nope.
So there are some geographic-specific constraints.
Right, there are. And one of the things that we had hoped to do, that we had hoped to look at, is there's a couple analyses that I want to do. One is, where are significant Latino populations in Texas? And we have to define that, what's significant, you know, or city, county figures. And then, you know, if we don't have affiliates there, that we actively go, because we don't actively recruit affiliates. People generally join because they hear about you or you have some kind of contact with them and they decide to apply for affiliation. So we have not actively recruited affiliates. So if we know that there's areas where there's significant Latino populations where we don't have an affiliate, we might want to put together a recruitment campaign to go into those communities and get somebody to connect with. The other thing is, there's communities where there are no CBOs to help serve them. You know, do we want to help create CBOs? I mean, these are issues that we need to look at. The other thing we'd like to run an analysis on is, what services do these guys provide and where do we have gaps? You know, we have 36 affiliates and 15 of them are doing affordable housing, and you've got one that's providing services for the elderly, you've got one that's doing child care services, you may have four or five that are doing education. You know, what are our major concerns for our community? Health, education, work, those kinds of things. And then how does the affiliate base fit into that, and where are there gaps that where we need to build? Like, I feel strongly that we need to build more and serve for people who are serving the elderly. There was a time when elderly services was very well funded by the federal government. Everybody was serving the elderly. Now that phase has ended, you just have one or two groups that are serving the elderly. And I think the elderly, particularly for Latino communities, are a very significant population, and you know, we should feel strongly about what's happening to them, particularly with this whole welfare reform issue.
What is the criteria for becoming an affiliate? Can the League of Women Voters join, or the Dominican Sud Association out of UT Austin?
Well, you have to be a 501c3. The board has to be Latino controlled, which 51% of the policymaking board has to be Latino.
What's Latino?
Any Hispanic, Puerto Rican, Mexican American, Chicano, as Judge Pena says, Cubans, any.
Brazilian,
I think.
Basque?
Sure.
Latinos. Spanish?
Spanish.
Italian?
I don't know about the Italians.
French?
I don't know. No, I don't think the French either.
Well, Napoleon III is the one that invented Latino.
We'll have to check. No, but then, and then they have to serve a predominantly Hispanic community.
So they could be the League of Women Voters.
In El Paso, right?
If they, well, I don't know. Is that an affiliate?
No, but I'm saying they could be. Like, for example, in some areas, chambers are.
Chamber of Commerce?
Chambers of Commerce are.
Not Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, just Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, if they have the, you know, the character.
51% of the board and serve
predominantly Latino communities.
Must be in McAllen, or maybe even Edinburgh.
So, I mean, there's a variety. And I've seen where we have, that the interpretation can be very broad. For example, to me, a community-based organization is an organization that serves a small geographic area in a particular community. But we have national groups that are affiliates. The American GI Forum is an affiliate.
Well, the Texas Migrant Council.
And the Texas Migrant Council.
At least
they're multi-state.
One-third of the year, they're not even in Texas.
Right. They're a multi-state agency, yeah.
What's your staffing pattern here?
Here in this particular office, we have five people. We have a person that works out of the workforce development component, which is our federally funded position, that is working to basically get representation on the workforce development boards of Latinos and of community-based organizations so that they work at the local level to make sure that their communities are served with all that DOL money that comes down locally, which is a very significant amount of money. We have a housing specialist who works with the groups that are involved in affordable housing. Basically, we review their financial packages or help them put their financial packages together for their housing developments. We can also help them shop their project around because we NCLR has national partnerships with Fannie Mae, with Nations Bank, with Bank of America, so that we can, you know, use some of our influence and some of our contacts to help them get their projects done. We have an administrative assistant who handles everything, and we have a revolving loan fund coordinator. And this is the only office and the only program in NCLR where we are the direct service providers. We do small business lending to businesses in rural areas along the border in a 17-county area from El Paso down to the valley and up to the Middle Rio Grande.
On the border being the county that actually sits on the border, not a contiguous or adjacent?
No, the counties that, well, some of them, I think there's two that are adjacent, but these are border counties, rural areas, so not the city of El Paso, but maybe Socorro or Horizon may qualify. And we work with a small business person. We help them develop their business plans. We do their financials, work with their financials. We take it to our loan review committee. And we lend. We're doing small business lending. And that's the only direct services project.
What budget is that amount?
That's a $1.2 million budget.
For the Texas office?
Right. That's only out of Texas. USDA funded, which is why it stays in rural. But we're working with Levi Strauss and other organizations to capitalize the grant so we can capitalize the loan funds so that we can expand the program beyond just those rural counties. And then myself, and basically I do a little bit of affordable housing development, economic development, but my main role here is organizational development. It's how to work with those community-based organizations and build their boards of directors, build their financial accounting capacity, and make them strong organizations so that they can serve their community and perform under the funding sources that they have.
What is your turnover rate in staff? Zero.
Almost zero. No, I have had one person leave.
What's your salary?
It's not much. My salary?
Yes.
You really want my salary? Yeah. My salary is $47,000.
Isn't that a critique of nonprofits that that they can't compete with the private sector salaries and they can't keep good people? How do you keep a zero turnover and why do you stay?
Because this is the kind of work I like to do. I have to tell you that I have been offered some very nice positions with some very nice banks. And I'm saying nice banks because I don't know how nice banks are. But I didn't feel like I could, even though they told me that I could do lending in my community. I know that banks have restrictions and banks have federal regulators and banks have bankers. You know, I'm not a banker. I don't see why banks can't, you know, take that extra risk and fund some of the projects that our groups are doing. And so even though the money was more, I didn't feel that I would be happy there. I love this work. This is work. You don't do it because for the pay. You do this work because you're committed to what it is you're doing, because the pay is never going to be there. So you just have to be, and that's what we have in this office. We have people who are just incredibly committed to working in the Latino community, and the rewards are the groups. The rewards are the Betulueras calling you and telling you, you know, that they have a little problem or that, you know, they might need a little help, or them calling you and inviting you to be their honored guest at their annual fundraiser or whatever, and you go and you see all the kids or go to the graduations of the kids that are graduating from the George I. Sanchez High School in Houston or the Raul Izaguirre Middle School in Houston. So, that's what we do. And it's fun work. It's making things happen.
What's your typical work week? What do you do?
Well, that's hard. I never get around to the paperwork. It's one, and it's a variety of things. It's one thing after another. It's phone calls. It's answering emails. Let me tell you, between the phone and the email, now you have double of what you have to respond to. But typically, it's I try to contact every affiliate at least once a quarter, either to remind them about the meeting or to talk to them about an action alert or whatever. I try to do that. I try to visit them as often as I can. If I have meetings that are being held in certain areas, I try to go and I try to take an extra day so that I can visit all of them. I travel a lot. You know, it's not unusual to be gone 2 or 3 days a week because our programs are all over the state. And we're a national intermediary, which means that we get funds that go to the nonprofits. So we are constantly monitoring those contracts and providing the technical assistance and support for that. So, you know, traveling 2 or 3 days a week, just visiting with the groups, helping them with their financial records. We've got, for example, a group in Sparks in El Paso County. It's the Colonia. And so we're there with these women who are just incredible. But they have no formal training, and now they're keeping the organization's records on QuickBooks. So they need a lot of support. They're also rehabbing 8 houses. They've never administered a grant before, and now they have a state grant for $210,000 that they have to administer. So we will go and make sure that their reporting is in on time, help them with whatever they need to do so that they get those financial, they have their financial records in order and so forth so that the state can continue their funding. I meet with community reinvestment officers from banks. There's one coming to see me this afternoon. I try to work with the different agencies here or in the communities that we're working in. For example, Enterprise Foundation has an office here in Houston, LISC has an office in Houston, to try and collaborate and coordinate, because these guys, LISC and Enterprise specifically, Neighborhood Housing Services, get incredible amounts of earmarks from the federal government and from people. We want to make sure that some of that goes into our community and that they award some of that money to some of our groups that are working in the barrios.
Does it? LISC notoriously has been pro-black and seldom done anything with Mexicans.
It has been a struggle. It has been a struggle. I mean, and it's sometimes, you know, we get to the point of shouting at each other across the table because they're very resistant to it, which is one of our, which is what we are documenting or attempting to document to the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation's position is, well, why should NCLR need a PRI program, a program-related investment program, which is basically low-interest money that we could lend to our groups, when they could just as easily go get it from Enterprise or LISC? But the point is that they can't easily get it from Enterprise or LISC. I mean, Raul has to use his power to say, I sit on your board and I want some of this, you know, money to go into our communities. But it rarely does, but we try to work with them. In Houston, we got LISC involved in the tax credit project that AMA did, the multifamily project. But, you know, the project was based on some of their commitments, and then at the end they wanted to pull their commitments, so we were...
What's the basis of that reluctance or resistance?
Discrimination?
Black-brown tensions? Is that basically it?
I know in Houston, I would say it's definitely a black-brown issue. I mean, Houston is probably one of the most racist places in Texas that I have to work in. Although I don't know if Dallas is that far behind, but... it's very obvious.
Well, in the Enterprise in Dallas, it's white against brown.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very...
They do mostly white projects, some black, hardly any Mexican
right.
projects.
Yeah, it's very... it's difficult. I mean, you're constantly fighting those kinds of battles. While we're fighting those battles with trying to get our groups to get their fair share, we're also trying to develop our own programs. So that, I mean, we don't always want to be in the position where we're begging. You know, and we've talked to a lot of our affiliates, and they are very excited about, you know, if they have to borrow money and pay back interest and fees, they'd rather do it to NCLR than to the Enterprise and LISC of the world. And so we're moving into that direction.
Does NCLR own its own real estate or its own operation or equipment, furnishings?
Well, we own the furniture and the computers and stuff like that, but as far as real estate, Assets, no. We don't. Now, I know that in Washington, I believe that they are looking at the possibility of purchasing a building, our own building. When you think about the money we spend in rent, and of course, I tell you, when I send our budget in, our rent is so low compared to what rent cost up in D.C. and L.A. I mean, they're just ecstatic when we get our, when they see our bill. But I mean, it's a lot of money. NCLR puts a lot of money into rented space, and so, you know, we're looking at that as an option, is how do we, you know, own our own real estate. And we're encouraging the affiliates to do it. And we're looking at a program that we call, we're calling Partnerships of Hope, which basically says NCLR, we can raise some low-interest money that we would have to relend, either some CDFI money from one of the banks, it's Community Development, CDFI, Community Investment, forgot what that stands for.
Community Development Investment Fund.
Fund, right. And what we do is, like, we would borrow the money from anywhere from 0 to 3%, and then we could lend it out at 6, 7%, or even less if we wanted to. So we're looking at raising that kind of money. We're putting those proposals together now. And we're talking to the affiliates about us coming in as a lender on their project, or NCLR coming in as an equity partner. And then they would be able to buy us out, you know, at some point down the road. So in order to help them do that, because we're really encouraging the nonprofits not only to own assets, but to develop activities and raise money for themselves. If you're going to build your own office building, add a few extra 1,000 square feet and rent it, so that you're bringing in some income that comes into the organization to at least support yourself.
That certainly makes sense. Like with the Texas Migrant Council, they rent office space and Head Start space everywhere. I don't think that they own any of it.
Right. And that's one of the things,
too. So does Texas Rural Legal Aid.
I remember when I was with the county, and then when I left the county and ran a nonprofit, that it's very difficult when you're totally federally funded to acquire real estate assets, because a lot of the grant fundings prohibit you from doing it. Some of the grant funding even prohibits you from purchasing office equipment, which is crazy, because what you pay in leasing this stuff, you could have bought 10 times more because of, you're constantly leasing the same old stuff. I mean, you know, and...
Well, that's what I was suggesting, that the National Council could be the motor for that kind of development and capacity building.
Right.
You become the real estate agent. You become the insurer. You become the office product salespeople, and so on. Given all the information that everybody knows about all the affiliates, just selling office supplies, you would be able to compete with Office Depot.
I think we're starting to look at those kinds of things, because as we started to look at what would be best for the affiliates, you know, we ought to practice what we preach. And so we need to do that as well.
Well, you started alluding to when you worked for the county and blah, blah, blah. Why don't you tell us how you got here? Your trajectory, your public service trajectory.
Wow.
When did it start that you pegged it at starting, and how did you get here?
Well, it was not a planned move. I mean, coming.
You've been here about 5 years, no?
Almost four years. I've been here 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
You beat out Reyes.
Cortez. No, Reyes wanted to stay in the valley. It was Pablo Aguillon, I think, who applied as well.
Okay.
Crystal City.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, before this, I was working with the Bexar County Local Development Corporation, which was a economic development corporation that was funded by the county with CDBG funds. Prior to being at the LDC, at the Local Development Corporation, I was at the county. I ran the county CDBG program. I started out at the county with a program called Bexar County Metropolitan Youth Agency, which was funded by the state of Texas out of the governor's office, Criminal Justice Division of the governor's office, to work with kids and to survey kids throughout the county. We did a countywide survey in all the school districts, trying to assess where kids are, what they were thinking about, where they wanted to go, did they have higher aspirations, did they see a bigger and brighter future for themselves, or, you know, what was it, what were their perceptions? It was really interesting, because we did Alamo Heights, we did Harlandale, we did, you know, the kids up at Churchill, and we went over to Edgewood. And it was a very interesting survey, and the results were incredible. I mean, to the Harlandale, for example, the kids there were looking at very basic needs, you know, like graduating and going into the service. And, you know, having your own paycheck and being able, you know, to support yourself. Very hardworking kids, or even any though, if they talked about going to college, they talked about how they were going to work their way through college. Or you go to Alamo Heights, and there was a sense of it was expected that they would go to college, but they hadn't a clue about how they were, you know, somebody was going to pay for it. So it was real interesting too, and the family, the way kids felt about, you know, families, you know, the poorer kids seemed more connected to their families. So that's why that was my first job with the county. And from there, that office expanded and we became the Human Resources Office of the county. We had gotten some grants to do utility assistance, rental assistance. Actually, the county got sued. The county got sued by Legal Aid, Bexar County Legal Aid, because the county was not providing support to indigents, which is a state statute. The city was providing some assistance through some of their federal monies, where they were providing rental assistance and emergency food and emergency utility assistance, but people that lived in the county were not eligible. So we initially started by applying for grants and getting some county money to provide the same types of services in the balance of Bexar County. Then Legal Aid came back and sued us again and said everybody's in Bexar County. So we had to expand the program again. So, and basically what we did was utility assistance, which, you know, was until the money ran out. And sometimes, I mean, we were putting out about $70,000 a week in utility assistance. And it is amazing the number of families that live without electricity inside the city limits of the city of San Antonio. The number of people who don't have water, who can't pay their water bill. So we expanded it to the electricity and water. And then we did some rental assistance, but it was still very limited. In doing that, as I was running those programs, the county got hit with handicapped access. And none of the county buildings were accessible to the handicapped, even though we did have a handicapped county judge at one time. Blair Reeves used to roll his wheelchair up the stairs by himself. And if he leaned a certain way, he wouldn't fall back. So then, eventually, somebody built Judge Reeves a ramp. I'm sure maintenance did that. But it was not in compliance with any of the codes. So as we were struggling with how do we meet this handicapped accessibility issue, I came across a federal regulation about urban counties getting direct federal money under the Community Development Block Grant Program. So I went through the process of applying for urban county designation for Bexar County, where I had to go, but we needed a population of 200,000. Mm-hmm. The county population, outside of all the little suburban cities, the county population was, it was like 149,000 or 147,000. So we were short the 200,000. So I needed to go to the suburban cities and get them to sign on with us to allow us to count their population. I went to Somerset, I went to Elmendorf, not a problem. Some cities, and I set it up to where I would have one of the commissioners or the county judge go with me, because I was going to Alamo Heights and asking Alamo Heights to sign on so that we could get money for poor people. My worst experience was Hill Country Village. There was a retired HUD employee that was in the audience that just fought tooth and nail against Hill Country Village signing on. The issue was that they didn't want welfare mamas and people like me in their city. and that if they signed on with us, that they would be signing, they would be opening their doors to affordable housing in their community. You know, forget the fact that that's federal law anyway, and as part of the United States, they were bound by federal law. They would not sign on, and it was very nasty. I guess I had never been directly impacted by discrimination as I was. I mean, you know, where these city council people and this mayor were talking about my people, you know, and your people, and your welfare mamas, and, you know, they keep having babies, and all of these, you know, and I mean, it was something that I had never experienced before. I was pissed. I mean, I was just furious. I mean, and it came to a point where they had come into the county, Hill Country Village came into the county and said they wanted the county to approve some funding for some major road that they had to have. And the commissioners approved it. And John Longoria had gone out to Hill Country Village also to try and see if they could say they would sign up. They gave him a worse time than they gave me. And he stood up and he said, I'm going to vote for this because it's the right thing to do. It's right because, you know, the people in that community need the service and they can't get it without Bexar County support. He says, however, at some point we would like for that community to do what's right for somebody else. But they never signed on. Universal City signed on. We got the 200,000 population, so we applied for the funds. Our first year grant, I think, was a little over $1 million. 600,000 of that went to handicapped access of county-owned buildings, ramps, and you know, we had nutrition, senior citizen nutrition sites in community centers that were owned by the county that were not handicapped accessible, so we had to do all of that. But we did, in addition to that, we did a little community center out in Madonna, out here on the southwest side. It was a great program, except the commissioners wanted to put everything in brick and mortar. You forget that the H in HUD means housing, and nobody really wanted to get into housing. But eventually we did a little housing rehab program, and we really started to move that program along. They wanted to do a lot of road reconstruction and that kind of stuff. They did try to give Universal City an ambulance, which was not an eligible activity, so it was not very popular with the commissioners because they wanted to just do what they wanted to do. So I wouldn't let them. So we had some pretty interesting commissioners court meetings over those kinds of issues of, you know, where the money should go and who should be impacted, because we used to do an analysis as staff and say, these are the neediest census tracts, and these are the projects that, because the communities would submit projects that they wanted, and we would say, this project, you know, may impact fewer people, but these people are needier than, you know, these projects. And then when you told a commissioner or county judge that his project was totally ineligible, you know, they were like, well, we can go ahead and fund it, and then if HUD decides it's ineligible later, then we'll deal with it. Well, I kind of felt like if that happened later, they'd remember that I was the one that was there, not that they wanted to do it. But besides that, I mean, it's just clearly ineligible projects. The Universal City one stands out because, I mean, the judge just really wanted to do that one. So, but we didn't do it. I mean, then I would write to HUD and ask for a determination, and they'd get upset that I would, you know, that I went outside of the county to ask. But I mean, I knew it was ineligible, so I wanted it in writing just to keep them on the straight and narrow. I mean, it's hard to do that when you're in those positions and you have those elected officials that are there and they have in their minds what they need for their constituents or what their constituents want, or, and it's more than, it's less than their constituents, it's their outspoken or influential constituents, because they don't always talk to all of their constituents, just for those constituents that mean more to them. So, but that was fun. I mean, it was challenging, and I never backed down, you know, and we had some, I mean, there were some nasty meetings and stuff, but.
From what you remember, what were some of the interesting comparisons or stories you might want to share between dealing with Anglo commissioners, county officials, and Mexican-American county officials or commissioners?
There's a couple, and I, you know, at the time when we had the majority of our elected officials were Mexicanos.
The county, you mean?
At the county. It was my anticipation that we had arrived, that our day had come. I was very excited about it. But what I found was that they were so worried about being perceived as being preferential to Mexicanos that they would go the opposite direction. So we were worse off. As a matter of fact, when I got promoted to director, they had done a reorganization, and my boss had got promoted to an assistant county administrator or whatever. He had gone to the courthouse. And so they promoted me to be the director of community resources. Commissioners did not want to give me a raise. They wanted me to do it for the same salary that I had been working before, which was about $25,000 less than the guy who was there before me. When I went to Commissioner's Court to talk about that increase, the only ally I had at that time, believe it or not, was Lamar Smith.
The current congressman pushing all the anti-immigrant legislation.
Right. That one, that very same one. He stood up and he fought for me, saying that it was only fair, you know, that I be compensated for, you know, taking on this. I mean, and he got me a raise. It wasn't the full amount, but I mean, he pushed it and he got me a raise. And, you know, I always thank him for that. But I met with him recently, a couple of years or a year back on the immigration issue. And he was like, "Don't you remember that I helped you?"
You remember.
He remembered. I said, "Yes, I remember that very well, and I thank you. However, on this issue, you're way off." I mean, this was just a bad, bad issue. He and I were fighting about the guest worker program. He liked that legislation, and being a rancher, I guess he would. But it was very disappointing. Very disappointing to finally exercise the process of, you know, voting these people in and getting enough Mexicanos out there to vote and really, you know, thinking that you had accomplished something, and then you find that, you know, they're so concerned about perception issues. When on the other hand, an African American gets in or an Anglo person gets in, they're not measured by preferential treatment that they give to their constituents, but our elected officials feel like they are. And you know, it's we need to hold them more accountable.
You said you had a couple of stories. That's just one, or is the other story something similar over at City Hall?
Something similar over at City Hall. I'm not thinking of what that is right now.
Well, I'm just saying you said a couple.
Yeah, that's the only one I can think of right now. I might think of some others later.
Well, how did Mexicanos fare under Henry B. Cisneros? Henry C.
Under Henry C.
Cisneros.
Well, now that was at the city, and I didn't have... my perception is that they did okay. I mean, we had... And some of those Mexicanos are still there. You got Rolando Bono still there as the assistant city manager. The thing with Henry, I wouldn't say that he did a lot for minorities here, for the Mexicanos. Henry did a lot for the city, period. I mean, he is a man with vision, and not that I agreed with any of everything he did, because I still think the dome was unnecessary, but he was moving the city, and economic development was moving. Now, and I think he was looking at more than just tourism. He was looking at the service industry, but for example, we have the American Airlines Reservation Center here. We have the Citicorp banking credit card center, which pays very well, and it's jobs with benefits. You get to buy stock options in the company, and those. So the telemarketing was a very big issue. He also tried to go into the biotech kinds of things. So it was tourism certainly took the lead. I mean, we have more hotels and restaurants and peanut vendor jobs than probably most communities. But there was also this other vision. And, you know, telecommunication, telemarketing kinds of stuff, it's clean industry. I mean, it's not, you don't have environmental problems. And generally, if we watch them, because I think we need to watch them, like the West telemarketing, if you're not full-time, you don't get benefits and all that kind of stuff. I think that when people are given abatements, that local government needs to really watch that trend that goes on. And I don't think we set up any of those kinds of follow-up procedures so that nobody knows if the companies ever kept their commitments under the tax abatement issues. But since Henry's left, there's been no economic development growth in San Antonio. I mean, it just like stopped. And I mean, you know, but we're still building hotels and we still have, you know, the maids. And of course, we're always first in line for those jobs. So we have a lot of those.
So before the county, where did you work? Where did you start your career?
When did you finish
your schooling, or when did you stop your schooling?
Well, I never finished my schooling. I got married when I was 20. I was at St. Mary's. I didn't finish college there. I had 2.5 years. I had a son, Michael, and he's now 27. So when I was going to school, after I had Michael, my grandmother would take care of him for me. I was working with one of those student aid jobs that they have at school, and I got placed in the city's youth services project. So that's kind of my first real awareness. I grew up on the south side in St. James Parish, home of cops. Beatrice was my piano teacher, as a matter of fact. But my father, civil service. My mom didn't work.
What's Beatrice's last name?
Beatrice. Is it Cortez? Cortez, yeah. My father was very protective. As a matter of fact, you spoke at St. Francis. Mario was with you, Mario Cuprion was with you, and you. And y'all came to St. Francis Academy at one of our assemblies, and you were talking about the Raza Unida party and stuff. And my dad went in there and said, come here, you're going to get in trouble.
What was he doing there?
The assembly was after school, and he had come by to pick me up, and he was like, what are you listening to these people for? You're going to get in trouble. Well, of course, I went to St. Mary's, and, you know, you guys were all... Influence was all over St. Mary's, and we used to go to the round table with Charlie Cottrell and study, have a few drinks and stuff. So it was interesting, and my poor dad was like, you're going to get in trouble. Well, I never got into trouble, but, you know, my dad worked 2 or 3 jobs at a time, if you remember, because we sent us all to Catholic school. Was hardly ever home. We used to, on weekends, he used to work at the Conoco service station down the block from where we lived, and we used to go and spend the afternoon with him there just so that we could see him. And I used to love the smell of gasoline. My dad smelled like gasoline. He was a printer, so he worked for Burkholder Printing here, and so he would do all the typesetting and stuff, and you know that smell of all the print shop and stuff, you know. We grew up with that. When I got married and after I had Michael, I got the student aid job at Youth Services Projects. The very first time I had ever been into a housing project. And my first assignment was Yala San Apeche Courts. And I worked with what they call them, pre-delinquents, pre-adjudicated youth, which was great. I mean, I just loved it. Even to this day, I have some of those kids who are now adults come by and see me. I can remember 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I would get a call and I would be picking up 12, 13-year-old young girls from bars on the west side of San Antonio. That they would call that they were stranded or whatever, and my husband worked at night, so I put Michael in the baby car seat and we'd drive over to the west side and pick up the kids, and if their parents wouldn't let them in the door, I'd take them home with me. So I did that for a while, and then the county got the grant for the Metropolitan Youth Organization.
Well, who did you marry?
I married Ricardo Terán. He was a political science major at St. Mary's. We have now been divorced about 14, 15 years, I guess.
Michael was the only child you had?
No, I have a daughter, Chris. She's 20 years old. Well, she's going to be 20 on the 18th of this month. She's a sophomore at St. Edward's in Austin, having a great time.
Why did you decide to get married and not finish school?
I thought I could do both. You know, hey, so what's a little extra, you know? I thought I could do both. I ended up, you know, I got pregnant right away, so I stayed home with Michael for a while, and then I went to work. Richard was still in school, so he needed to finish school.
Did you want to get pregnant, or just simply unawares?
I wanted to. And so...
So you knew that that was going to be a triple load then?
Oh, yeah.
The husband, the child, and the school.
Sure, sure, yeah. So, you know, but, you know, things don't always work out, you know, so then you had medical... I mean, you had bills mounting, and, you know, we couldn't afford daycare, so my grandmother would take care of Michael most of the time, but, you know, there were times when she couldn't. So, you know, it was just, you know, typical me, you know, young, inexperienced, married, responsibilities, you know, no great job, you know, because nobody had finished school yet. So
in your family?
Well, Richard or I, we were both in school.
Oh.
So I got a job, and Richard stayed in school to finish. As a matter of fact, I did not finish my BA until December 18th, which was my daughter's birthday, of 1993. I mean, I would take a course here, take a course there, but then, you know, then you think, well, the kids get older. Well, there was soccer practice and piano lessons, and so you're always driving, you know? So it was like, okay, well, I'll only take one course this year, or maybe I'll take two next year. And, you know, so it was always a balancing act, or it was always, you know, what fits into the agenda this time, and what didn't fit was going to school, so you'd leave that out. But, you know, but I was always in school, you know, you know, and now I'm thinking about, you know, I should go back and get a master's.
So what's your mom and dad's name, and where did they come from? Any brothers and sisters?
Oh, yeah, I have my mom and dad. My dad is Edward Jimenez.
His name is Edward?
Mm-hmm. Edward F. Jimenez, and he was born here in San Antonio, right here on the west side. Went to Tech High School. He's a printer. He worked for Burkholder Printing for a long time that I can remember, and then he finally got a civil service job when we were in about the 7th or 8th grade, I guess. I have my mom is Alberta Garcia. She's from Refugio. My dad, when he first got out of the service, which he had lied about his age and gone into the Navy for World War II, and when he came back, the first job he got was in a print shop in Refugio. And that's how he met my mom. They got married. My older sister and I were born at Refugio, and then they moved to San Antonio after that.
Who's your older sister? What's her name?
Our name is Mary Villarreal.
That's the married name?
Uh-huh. And she's here in San Antonio. She works at the Sheriff's Department. Then I'm the second child. And then I have a brother, Edward Jr., who is very successful. He is he's in hospital administration, and he's into a partnership of nine medical care clinics here in San Antonio. And then I have a little sister, Grace, Grace English, and she...
That's her married name?
Uh-huh. She is currently staying home with her two babies. So, and having a great time. She's got great kids. Those are my siblings. It's my mom and dad.
Where did your grandparents come from? What are their names on either side?
My mom's parents are Garcias, Henry Garcia and Mary Garcia. They are basically from the Refugio Victoria area. My grandfather was a truck driver. My grandmother stayed at home. They had nine children, so a lot of cousins. My grandmother was a great cook, chicken and dumplings. But they both passed away, in my opinion, fairly young. I wasn't even married yet when my grandfather passed away. And my grandmother passed away when my daughter was three. My grandfather died on Halloween, and my grandmother died on Mother's Day. So we remember them a lot. My dad's parents, were from my grandfather's mother. My great-grandmother was from the Canary Islands. She came here. I don't exactly know why she came here, but then she was Flores, and then she met Jimenez from Mexico, but we never knew him. But my grandmother, my great-grandmother lived with my grandparents, so we sort of grew up with her. My grandmother was always a housewife, and she had passed away about 5 years ago. She was the one who held the family together. Every event, every holiday, you know, everybody had to go to grandma's. And every Sunday was visiting day. You had to go visit every Sunday, and you'd watch the Ed Sullivan Show in Bonanza, and then you'd have some ice cream and cookies and go home every Sunday. Really great, great people. My grandmother taught us how to sew. My grandfather was the last job that he had that I remember before he retired was he worked at Kelly Air Force Base. He was an airplane mechanic. And he had hundreds of certificates of all of these methods and processes that he developed that saved the government millions of dollars. And so he was very creative, always trying to figure out ways or to make life easier, to make things that you had to do easier. So he was always, you know, an ironing board that was easier to set up, or, you know, a little gadget to hold the iron in so the kids didn't get burned, or, you know, whatever. I mean, he was always thinking of how to do things and stuff like that. But they wouldn't buy a dryer because it was a waste of money, you know. So I was like, he's making everybody else's life easier except their own. They were, I guess, because they experienced the Depression. I mean, they saved and saved and saved. I used to remember going to visit them, and they would be eating beans and Vienna sausages. And I would tell them, you know, no, let me go buy you something to eat. Let me go get you a steak or chicken or whatever, you know. My grandfather would go, no, this is fine. Well, when they passed away, they left their three sons an incredible inheritance. I mean, it wasn't billions, but I mean, it was a significant amount of money. And, you know, my grandfather had, you know, that's what he had. I mean, he had worked for that, you know. And I think back about how much they sacrificed and how frugal they were, you know, and how they could have lived differently. But, you know, they had to have that money in the bank. They had to have something to leave. And so I thought that was pretty incredible that they would do that. I don't think many of us do that today.
What was your primary language back then?
Well, you know, it's really funny because we spoke a lot of English, but when at my grandparents' house, when I was younger, both of my great-grandmothers lived there. My grandmother's mother and my grandfather's mother. And neither one of them spoke English. And so we would speak to them in Spanish, but we would speak to everybody else in English.
What significant memories do you have of your early childhood or growing up and going to school? Good ones or bad ones, regardless.
Oh, they were great. I went to St. James School, Catholic school. It was great. I mean, a lot of nuns. Sister Rosemary was my first grade teacher. Sister Gemma was my fourth grade teacher. I remember when I was in the eighth grade, Father Joe Novak was the pastor of St. James, an incredible man. There was a lot of things going on at that time. You know, there was the priest, where there was a lot of dissension among the priests about, you know, being able to get married and all this kind of stuff. So a lot of the priests were falling out, you know. Father Hinckley, Father Castro, you know, these guys were leaving the priesthood. But, you know, Father Joe was very strong, and so he was the pastor, and he was would teach us religion in the eighth grade. And I remember when he came in to tell us that President Kennedy had been shot and died, you know. It was just like a family. It was like we knew President Kennedy. I mean, it was it was very emotional for all of us. But I mean, I had a great time in grade school, a great time in high school. I went to St. Francis, and that was an experience. One of the things that I was talking to the principal there a couple of years back, and she said, she says, all of our girls that graduated from St. Francis, she says, they're so strong. And I think that's something that they really let us have. They let us have our independence. they allowed us to be outspoken, which is, I guess, why you got to speak there. you know, when I think back, I mean, Yolanda Arellano, you know, has run for office here a couple of times, and she's a very strong person. So, I mean, that's something that they really fostered in us, and I really appreciated that they let us have that. But I loved school. I was the editor of the school newspaper.
So you had already discovered politics then?
Oh, yeah, I was...
When did you discover that?
Well, actually, when I was at St. Francis, and I was on the school paper, we used to cover a lot of the events. I remember when Hubert Humphrey came down to and spoke in front of the Alamo, and it was myself and this other girl that was with me. I was a reporter, she was the photographer, and had to fight our way in the crowd, and Henry B., I told Henry B. who we were and what we were doing, so he got Hubert Humphrey over, we got to take our picture with him. We covered George Bush when he was here, when he was before he became president. We got to meet Nixon, but I wouldn't take my picture with him.
You would not?
I would not.
How old were you?
I was in high school, I don't know, 16, 17. And I was like, no, thank you.
What made you do that? What feelings did you have about the man?
That he was not a poor, a little people's person. And that, you know, and I kind of felt like, well, you know, I took a picture with Humphrey. I took a picture with George Bush. But it was like, I didn't feel like with them that it was, I kind of felt with Nixon like it would be something about, look, see, I like everybody, or, you know, I even like Mexicans, or, you know, something like that. I just like, and people can say, oh, you know, this is a, you know, guy, this guy's going to be president, you know, you should have your picture taken with him, you know, then you could say you had your picture taken with the president. Well, years later, I could say I had my picture taken with the president because I had my picture taken with George Bush. But it was, you know, I told him that I'd write the story, but I won't get in the picture with him. And so his picture came on the paper with none of our students in it, because I was just the two of us that went, so the photographer had to take the picture. But now that I think back on it, I guess it was a smart move.
speaking of leadership, who is the most effective leader in the Mexican-American community today?
That's difficult to say. I would say that in our world, in our community development world that I work in and that I live in, I give a lot of credit to Raul Seguera. And I didn't know Raul before I got this job. I have to tell you that I didn't know NCLR before I got this job. I just answered an ad in the paper and did not have an inkling about what this organization was about. Never heard of it. Since I've been here, and, you know, I can see, and believe me, Raul and I don't agree on a lot of issues. And, you know, I probably don't have, sometimes I tell myself that I don't have all the facts, so I don't know why, you know, we do certain things. But, you know, I guess if you're going to be at that level and if you're going to be at those tables, you have to negotiate. And negotiating means that you're going to have some compromise on your part as well as Congress or whoever. And sometimes I'm not a compromising person, which is probably why I would never get to Raul's level. Because, you know, for me, there is no compromise. A closed border for me is totally unacceptable. This is America, you know. But NCLR has taken a position on a closed border for some legitimate reasons. I mean, defend the border at the border. Don't come into the communities and do raids on businesses and this kind of stuff. And, you know, and I can see that, but I only think that there are some closed borders in the U.S., not all closed borders. And so, but, you know, they're at the negotiating table. But I think Raul has done a lot. I think he has certainly sacrificed a lot, you know, good or bad, or, you know, whether we agree with his politics or not. I mean, the guy has sacrificed a lot. A lot, you know, you have too. I mean, your time away from your family and all that kind of stuff. And Raul is just, but he's well read. His thinking is very analytical. He looks at a lot of sides of an issue. It's good that he's on our side. The most difficult situation I have seen him in was when we had the conference in Denver, Colorado, and Coors was one of our sponsors. And I had happened to have been there for a meeting and was told that Earl was having this community meeting. So I went to the community meeting, and there were some very, very angry Mexicanos there that were proposing to boycott the conference if Coors was the sponsor. So Earl told him, show us some facts, and we'll tell them no. And Peter Coors was there, too. And we'll tell them no. We'll say, take your money and go home. There was a lot of ranting and raving, you know how we do. You know, we feel this, we sense this, we do this. But when you really got down to it, there's been a change, and of course, you know, you have to look like how long is long enough to forgive? I mean, do you blame Peter Coor for all of his ancestors and everybody else? Some of us say yes, some of us say no. But, you know, the issue, Roel took it very systematically. An agreement had been entered into with Coors. Coors met every issue on that agreement. It was an agreement that Latinos had drawn up. Roel was one of the people on that committee, but there were a lot of people who sat there, who worked out this negotiated agreement, who negotiated these specific terms. And so the Coors company had met all those conditions, and now we were saying, well, yeah, that's what we asked you for, but that's not enough. So, and there's some truth to that. But, you know, I kind of felt like we should have been more prepared on, the community people should have been more prepared with facts to answer back, or to respond back, if they could. Maybe there weren't any facts there. But, I mean, the meeting was very low-key, no press, although there was a little article in the newspaper about it the next day. But I mean, and there were people who were very angry, who made very angry statements toward Raul. And he kept us cool. He agreed to investigate certain things that people had brought up. And he did. When he left there, he did. And he wrote letters back to everybody who was in attendance. And between that time and the time of conference, which was like 3 months, all the issues had been resolved. But even when we were leaving the meeting, once the meeting was over and Raul walked out the door, the people were friendly with him, you know. And so it was like whatever was said in that room on this particular issue was not personal, and it stayed in the room. And, you know, when that issue was discussed, those were the issues there. But outside of that environment, they were still his friend, and they were, you know, still very supportive of all the other things that he did. And then he followed up on all of the concerns that they had brought up. They researched them. They sent back, NCLR at the national office sent back, this is what we've been able to discover. If you have information that differs from this, let us know, and we'll check that out also. And so we went through who the Coors Foundation gave to, and I mean, they give to everybody. The Heritage Foundation, I mean, they give to all of them.
But all so the does, nasties.
But so does Ford. And so does, you know, Rockefeller. And so does, you know, all of these other people. And none of us were turning down Ford money. So, you know, there's that issue. I mean, we have some discussions. I mean, we have a proposal to receive money right now from Levi Strauss. I have boycotted Levi Strauss for years, personally.
Because of what happened here locally?
Because of what happened here.
Fuerza Unida or Mujeres Unidas?
Yeah. Yeah, here locally, the San Antonio
closed. What's the name of the women's group?
Mujeres Unidas, mm-hmm. Which was the plant here that closed. You know?
And they were left without retraining.
And, well, retraining money was given to the city. So, and the city decided that everybody should be nurses' aides. Well, give me a break. You know, I sat here sewing pockets on jeans for 20 years, so I'm not going to be a nurse's aide. And, you know, the skill level, the reading level, the age and health of these women, I mean, all of these issues were insignificant. The thing was, is you were a piecemeal worker yesterday, today you're a nurse's aide. And they did. 99.9% of them didn't make the transition. And it was like, oops, sorry, all the money's gone. You know, it was so there were a lot of players there and a lot of people to blame. I still find it hard, although I do work with the Levi Strauss Foundation people here. We do some things. They fund some stuff. They fund some of NCLR's projects. It's just a...
Well, isn't that one of the running criticisms of NCLR, and Raul in particular? I'll mention two. During the Howard Stern derogatory comments about Selena, many community groups sprang up boycotting various sponsors of Stern, many of whom are sponsors of NCLR. And Raul, from what I read of and heard of allegations, did not take a position. Then more recently, with Larry Merchant, said those ugly things about mariachi music at the second to the last De La Hoya fight. Raul privately complained to the Time Warner people, because that's who owns HBO, and was unable to get Larry Merchant suspended, just merely rebuked. People criticized him and NCLR for being too tied to corporate interest to be really independent and vocal and assertive.
Well, he did.
What's your take?
He did get suspended for a few games. But, well, let me tell you that sometimes we all have a role to play, and there's some, and we all play those roles very well, and I think we all support each other, and all the puzzle pieces fit. Lulac, for example, can get up and scream and complain. And NCLR, and I will tell you this, we study issues to death, which is why a lot of times we don't get any press coverage, because by the time we come out with a position or a statement, the event is so old that it's not covered. I mean, because I know that on the Selena issue, I mean, we got flooded with phone calls on the marine issue. We got some calls on that too.
No.
The thing is that what happens is I'll get the call. I'll call our public relations people in Washington, and they'll say, okay, for the Howard Stern thing, they go, okay, we're getting transcripts of what he actually said. You know, we're looking at this, we're looking at that. You know, and they'll go through all of that. But I mean, it takes a while. It takes weeks. I mean, the Kmart issue. There was an issue where they were displacing some families up in Virginia, and CLI was instrumental in getting those people relocation monies and all kinds of stuff. But we weren't not out in front on this issue here in Arkansas, where, you know, they had the discrimination against. We don't respond emotionally, and we don't react to stuff on the spot. We take the situation, we read about it, we gather all our facts, it's reviewed, you know, there's senior staff, and then a position is either it's decided to take a position or not take a position, and then if you take a position, then you write out what that position statement is. My experience has been that sometimes we take too long in that process, and by the time we have an opinion, nobody cares. And it's buried someplace. I mean, I have the hardest time getting the San Antonio Express and News to pick up anything because of the response time of how long it takes us to respond back. I mean, and the Selena deal was 2 weeks before we had, you know, a response, and everybody's like, hey, that's old news.
How do you figure that a Jesse Jackson can do a land blast, an attack on a Texaco or anybody, and get them to the negotiating table immediately, an apology and money? That's been basically the format and formula that he's followed successfully, and Raul or NCLR can't.
Well, I think we do some of that, not at probably at that level, but I think that's it's not just a Raul issue, an NCLR issue. It's a whole Latino issue. Look in Houston. If the African Americans are upset, everybody runs to respond immediately. If the Latinos are upset, nobody pays attention. look here in San Antonio when they were closing the fire stations, most of them in the inner city minority communities. This gentleman organized, took 200 plus people, packed City Hall, all Latinos. Nothing was done. T.C. Calvert comes in with his 20 African Americans and they drop everything. Let's go. Okay, let's go. We got to fix this. We are not perceived as a threat. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if they look at our voting history and decide that we don't impact them or what. But, I mean, it's disturbing. It's very disturbing. And, you know, how we get around that, I don't know. But I will say that on a lot of these issues, there is negotiation. There is some money, not as much as the African-American community gets. But all of these things are done, except that we don't have the hype up front. And maybe we need to do more of that. Maybe we need to get out in the camera more and say, you know, NCLR will not tolerate this, da 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 da. We generally do a lot of this stuff quietly. I mean, you know, there was a negotiation with American Airlines on that training manual that they had out that I don't think was widely publicized. And then, I don't know, maybe we need to buy the press. Maybe we need to purchase ads and do this because I don't think we get equal coverage.
Well, even internally, NCLR doesn't blow their trumpet enough. I never read anything about the success of negotiating with American Airlines.
All I got from here was a press release that had gone out to the media, but it didn't get published.
You alluded to the comparison to blacks. What about the poor state of relations between NCLR and black organizations? Raul has walked out on occasion, threatened to walk out. The tensions seem to be superficial there on the surface. What is all that about? What are the black and brown tensions, the underpinnings of tension?
You know, I think a lot of it is fear. And it's hard to fight or reason with fear.
On whose part?
On the part of the African Americans. I think when you see a lot of momentum being built up on English only, that the Anglo community gives the African American community the impression that they need to protect themselves, and so then they tend to vote with the white community on some of these issues. But the fear is that if the Latinos get more, they have to get less. It's got to come from someplace. And the issue is, when we go to fight for more equal access or whatever, we try to make it very clear to say that it's not we want a part of the African American's share. We want our own share. And so, but there, I saw this very clearly in Dallas in the Head Start program when we were working with some folks there about expanding the Head Start program to a number of Latinos that was more representative of the community. Well, the response was, well, we have to take it away from the African American community in order to give it to the Latino community. And so that leaves the African American community feeling that if the Latinos are going to get anything, it's going to be at their expense. And I think that is a scenario that has been developed by the Anglo community and that they kind of foster that. You know, and so we try to make it clear that we're not looking to take away from. We're looking to make the pie bigger and to get an appropriate share for the Latino community. But they don't hear that part. And I can tell you that it's been in, you know, congressional hearings and stuff, you will have the congressman or you'll have the senator say, well, if I give it to the Latinos, I have to take it away from the African American community. And so they kind of perpetuate and build on that fear, which, you know, we, and that's very hard to combat. I mean, that's just people's perceptions and feelings. It's not based on any fact or anything. So, you know, it's hard to combat that kind of thing. But, I mean, I can tell you that I have been, and I have operated programs where we've gotten funding at the national level, where the national funding partner will say in public meetings that NCLR gets a lot less and does a lot more than the African American community. And we're also held to higher standards and to higher results than others, because, and that's always been, I think we've always been there where we've had to do better and more.
What's the NCLR marching order on relations with Mexico? Those have been developing and improving and getting more institutionalized to the point now that for the first time in history, a Mexican president goes to a national convention in person. There had been videotaped messages in the past and representatives from Mexico.
Well, we have, Raul founded with some other people the Mexican American Solidarity Foundation, where it's an exchange program where we take leaders from the United States over to Mexico, and they get to meet their counterpart and see what's going on and study, and then they come here. As a matter of fact, there's going to be a meeting here in January with, you know, people from Mexico and the people here from the United States. So we're trying to foster better relations. We're trying to foster some more economic growth and equity between Latinos here in the United States and Latinos in Mexico. I mean, they're right there. It's, you know, that border is just a imaginary line. So, I mean, this is a country that's very, a foreign country that is very connected to us. Unless, you know, I mean, Texas was Mexico first. So, you know, and for us in Texas, it's even, you know, it's an economic issue. It's a family issue. You know, we don't see the division as much as other people do. I mean, and in some borders, it's even worse. You know, the division is less than at others. I mean, Puerto Juarez and El Paso, and there's just like no real border there. I mean, it's just all one community. And there's a lot of, and with NAFTA, of course, and with the NAD Bank and the projects that are on both sides of the border. I mean, this is something that's really developing. We did get a small grant, you know, under the NAFTA funding to do some economic development.
Isn't the bank headquartered here?
The bank is in San Antonio, yes.
Does it do anything?
Well, they're funding projects now. The problem is it's a bank, and people thought, oh, another grant-making organization. We have to change that whole way of thinking. The grant era is gone. I mean, I just saw a request for proposals from Department of Health and Human Services the other day that said that grant amounts up to a maximum of $250,000, and if you didn't meet your deliverables, then the balance of where you didn't meet the deliverables would be converted into a low-interest loan. The foundations are getting that way, too. Outcome funding is what they call it. So anyway, you know, we did get under, we're one of the domestic partners out of the NAD Bank to foster some economic development. Our money is all on this side of the border, but it's in the border area. You know, what we do subsectorial analysis and try to help the local workforce development people target their resources in those areas where people might really be able to find a job when they get out. Not put everybody in nurses' aides programs, and then there's no jobs for them when they finish. So we are working on you know, some of that NAD Bank stuff. So we do have a connection. And Raul met with the president as a result of this Mexican American Solidarity Foundation, and you know, offered a cordial invitation to. We have an annual conference. We'll be honored, and then but there was no follow up done after that, and it was the president of Mexico that called and asked, you know, if he could be on the agenda. So, I mean, that was, we felt kind of privileged about that. But, I mean, it's a role that, you know, Raul has taken on. I think it's a role that he really enjoys. You know, being from San Juan in the border area, he feels really connected there. And let's face it, a lot of us
you know, here in the Southwest, you know, are related some way, somehow over there. So, you know, there is that strong connection, and we do stuff for other countries. I mean, we do the Cuban thing, we do...
What do we do with Cuba?
We are working with trying to get the U.S. government to clean up the refugee camps that they have, and to treat these people with dignity and respect, and not just warehouse them like cattle in some of those horrible conditions. If these people are coming over for political asylum, they should be given the same courtesy and the same importance people coming from Russia for political asylum get. You know, and I know that Roel has done a number of inspections of those camps, a number of press conferences on, you know, the conditions in those camps and what we can do to clean up and what we can do to expedite those release of those Cubans, you know, from those camps, you know, whether they're rich or poor, you know, just how do we handle that, and how does this country, we talk so much about, you know, human rights, how do we treat people? You know, so, you know, as those issues come up, you know, Roel deals with them. The Mexico thing, you know, from my perspective, because I'm here in Texas, it's critical to me. You know, the economics of, you know, the economic impact that Mexico has on Texas, you know, and our people on the border. I mean, you know, when the devaluation of the peso hit, I mean, we suffered on this side as much as they suffered on that side. You know, these are all major concerns to us. We're working with the government of, you know, with the Maquiladora program, you know. Those people need to be paid decent wages. Those people need to have housing. You know, are these companies, all these American companies that are transferring our jobs across the border there, how are they treating those people that are on the other side? And we're working on a number of issues dealing with employer-assisted housing on both sides, and so forth. So, I mean, these are all major issues that impact us directly here in out of this office and out of the Phoenix office as well.
Do you, on a regular basis, meet with, I suppose, would be your peers or cohorts of other staff-led organizations like Al Kaufman at MALDEF or Camarillo over at Southwest Voter? Do you all meet regularly and talk about your mission as representatives of national organizations? Or
we really don't at this level. I don't know that they do it at the national level. We have some interaction. MALDEF, we work pretty close together. I mean, they're across the street there, and so we share a lot of information. But, you know, when I read about them suing over the task chest, I mean, I had to call Al and say, fill me in, you know, it's what's going on, you know, what can I send to Washington, you know, maybe we can help.
NCLR has no litigation program.
No.
NCLR has no voter registration program.
No, we encourage our, well, actually here, we did work a little bit with Southwest Voter when they were doing the trainings. We try to get all of our affiliates to go through the training on the voter registration drive that Southwest Voter puts on, so that they can do it in their individual communities. And the affiliate network would set goals like, you know, to register X number of new voters, to increase the voting, Latino voting by X number of percent. Now, we didn't measure any of that, so which is something that we would probably like to implement somewhere down the line. But we don't have any formal way of meeting. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights here in San Antonio always invites us, because we get to go talk to the mayor of the city of San Antonio once every month or once every other month. And so we get together and talk about issues that we want to take to the city council. And we meet an hour before we go see the mayor, and then we go in and you know, give the mayor two or three, four or five topics that we want him to consider, and follow up on some other stuff that we presented in the past. So. That
now, who is that group?
Is that a very local?
Is that the legal aid lawyers, but on a private capacity? Or?
It's a nonprofit. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. It's a nonprofit organization, a 501c3. As a matter of fact, they just got a.
Who's the director?
Peter Vaisigos. They just got a contract with from the Emma Lazarus Foundation.
On citizenship?
To do some stuff on citizenship. Yeah, so, you know, but they do a lot of the, you know, the meetings, the organizing. They have brown bag lunches every once in a while, too. You know, just, let's just talk about issues and stuff. But, you know, the different people go all the time. So it's not like a formal group that get together. So no, we haven't done that. We should probably do more. I think San Antonio is probably one of the few places where we have a lot of representation from most of the national organizations. So that would be a good idea.
What are some of the pressing issues in your mind facing the Mexican-American community today?
Education.
Any level, all levels, what kind of education?
All levels.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about access to good quality education for our kids from the time they're born on up. I'm talking about Head Start, our children learning how to read. I would really, really, but I am also concerned with that we need to be a bilingual community. Not just in Texas, but nationally. I mean, all the other countries know it. We're the only ones who are resisting it. And, you know, I would really wish the education system would build on both languages. I mean, come on, Tom Frost knows how to speak Spanish because it's an economic advantage to him. So, but we teach our children that it's not, you know, and so what the little that they have, we take away from them when they get started. But, you know, and to provide good quality education, not let kids slip through the cracks. 50% of our kids are not graduating from high school. I mean, that's a major, major issue. And aside from that, if you look at Texas and you look at the number of adults who are illiterate, and I know that the governor's launching his, you know, everybody will read by the third grade. Well, you got hundreds of thousands of people that are already out there that don't know how to read, that can't function in today's economy, and then you take all their support away from them and you expect them to go and flip burgers or whatever. I don't care what job you get, you got to read. You have to learn how to read. You know, we talk a lot, but I mean, employment and training monies is flowing out of everybody's ears here, but nobody's talking about, you know, how are we going to address the literacy issues? How are we going to address the dropout issues? How, I mean, these are things that are symptoms of something. The charter schools, I'm against the charter schools, the charter school concept, although NCLR has not taken a position on that. But we're taking...
Well, aren't some of your affiliates charter schools?
Yeah, we have three affiliates that have charter schools. But, and they're telling me, yeah, but look at the kids in these schools, you know. They have smaller classrooms, you know, the teacher-to- pupil ratio. They require parental involvement. You know, so I'm thinking, well, gee, duh, why don't we do that at all the schools? Why am I taking these 100 privileged children and giving them a better education than all the thousands of kids who are out there? Why don't we just fix the whole darn system instead of giving very few precious children the opportunity that not everybody else is going to get? And then what are we going to do about adult literacy? You know, are we going to wait till all of these hundreds of thousands of people get too old and die and then we don't have to worry about them anymore? I mean, you know, it's got to be a multi-level approach, because then you can't talk about getting sustainable jobs, jobs that they can support themselves and their families with, because without the education and the training, they can't get those jobs. Then you can't talk about affordable housing, because I don't care how affordable is, if you don't have a job and you're not educated, you can't get there. So, you know, I mean, they're not going to stop affordable housing, they're not going to stop the employment training, but there's huge gaps of people that are lost in between all of that. And not just Latinos, but there's huge gaps of people. And I get the sense sometimes that this society is willing to throw those people away.
This 50% figure that you said of dropout rates among Latinos, is that national or state or local, or where did you get that figure?
That's state.
Half of the Mexicanos going to school don't finish.
Don't finish. And, you know, it's not like the old times where you had to go work. Your family had to pull you out of school to go work. I mean, that happens to some of them, but we're just not meeting the kids' needs anymore. We're just not teaching children how to learn. And we've done, you know, I had Southwestern Bell tell me, you know, that they fund educational model programs, but as soon as their funding's over and you prove that the program works, the schools go back to the old way of doing business. Nothing changes. And so, you know, we need to do something. I mean, there needs to be something radical done. I don't know what, but we're losing it. We're losing all these kids, and now we are suffering from having this huge population that they're not trained well enough to do a lot of work. I mean, even maids need to read the labels on cleaning supplies and instructions that are left and all of this kinds of stuff. And, you know, nobody seems to be, you know, worried about that. Not enough people are worried about that.
Does NCLR have a cabinet committee structure? Do you all meet often, all the executives that are in D.C. and all the main representatives in the states like yourself?
The senior staff, which is our deputy vice presidents, vice presidents, and Raul, meet every other Tuesday in Washington. The field offices, we try to all get together at least twice a year. Sometimes we do it a little bit more.
Is one of those meetings during the National Convention?
No, we can't do anything during the convention. It's crazy. You know, you're lucky if you get to sleep. Forget the eating. That's too crazy. And then once a year, every other year, we have an all-staff retreat. Everybody, secretaries, you close down all the offices. And for 3 days, they take us out to the boondocks in Virginia where there's no phones, no TV, no nothing.
Does NCLR own that retreat place?
No.
Does an affiliate own that retreat place?
No. So, and we go and we meet and we discuss issues and we discuss priorities.
That's a couple of hundred people.
It's a lot of people.
Just the travel budget. Does NCLR own a real travel agency?
No, but we're talking about the travel agent part. But, I mean, you're talking about, and that happens once every 2 years. And then the in-between year, it's the senior staff and the office directors that get together and meet. And basically what we do there is we try to talk about our strategic plan and what our 5-year goals are, because we do 5-year strategic plans. And so are we implementing, where are we on the existing strategic plan, and what do we want to see for the next strategic plan? So that's basically what we do there. The component that I'm in, which is called Technical Assistance and Constituency Support, TACS, we meet more frequently. The office directors meet quarterly. And all staff has met twice, I think, since January.
There's been a shift in that vice president, no?
Yes.
He's now running the foundation and somebody else is running TACS?
Well, Esteban's now gone completely out of NCLR. He went back to Chicago. But Tommy Espinosa is now the vice president of tax.
The former director of Chicanos por la Causa.
Right. And Mark Van Brunt is the deputy director, and Bernardo Ramirez is deputy director.
Is there a successor in training program? Raul can't be there, God for life. Neither can the Anglo lady, or now the Anglo man, or the Japanese guy be our leaders forever. Is there any successor in training program going on?
I don't see any. It could be Tommy for all I know, but I don't see that. We talk about that. We mention that to Raul every time we have a retreat.
What's his answer or response?
You know, I think he's a little uncomfortable with the idea, but
of
having to train somebody to take his place. But I think he's well aware of it. I think he's like, yeah, you know, that's definitely an issue. But I think he's thinking that it will be one of the VPs from the ranks, and you know, that person just hasn't surfaced yet. So maybe it is Tommy. I don't know. Maybe they'll start to groom him. I'm not sure.
Well, but the greater issue, doesn't he see that they certainly cannot promote someone who's not Hispanic?
Oh yes,
and certainly he cannot grow anyone who's not Hispanic into other positions, and we are scarce,
right,
at executive levels in foundations and banks and government circles, and that's a good training ground. He's oblivious to that?
I tell you what, we lose a lot of people. The young people that come in, first of all, you know, to live on our salaries in D.C. is almost impossible. But we're definitely a training ground. People are stolen from us constantly. I mean, we're
so there's no upward mobility.
Yeah, right. We're constantly training people for somebody else. That happens all the time. But you're right. You know, there's really no step ladder in place. You know, my guess would be that the board would go to the outside to, you know, do a national search.
Well, the board's not even affiliate controlled. The board is a glamour board.
The board is one third affiliates, one third corporate, and one third special interest. So
that's worse than the War on Poverty programs ever were.
Well, yes, but you see, if all the affiliates would go to the meeting, they'd really always have the advantage because the others don't. I mean, you know, the corporate people, you know, their one third is hardly ever full. And special interest is the same. And since we pay for the affiliate board members to go to meetings, we don't pay for the others, but we do pay for the affiliate board members to go, it's easier for them to have all of their members present and to have a majority.
One third is not a majority.
Well, it would be
a majority at the meeting.
At the meeting, right.
At subsequent meeting, vote to reconsider. Well, I think there's some structural problems here. I was just going to ask you, in your gaze at the crystal ball, how much longer is Raul going to be the head of the NCLR, or is he going to die in office? He's been there 16 years, 15 years, 17 years?
25 years, 26 years.
When is enough enough?
I don't know. Hugo Berlanga just told me enough was enough. He's not going to run for re-election because 20 years was too much. I don't
was
know.
He joking?
No. Be serious.
I heard Truan was going to do that, and then it flipped.
Oh, no, I would never figure Truan for quitting, for giving it up. No, and I would never. I don't know when too much is too much for Raul, because, you know, I think NCLR is more of a family to him than his family. And he's with us more than he's with his family.
Well, that's just about everybody who works.
I know. He lives and breathes the stuff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I would like for the option to be there for him to retire when he's ready, because there's somebody coming. But you know, this is not only an NCLR issue. This is a Latino issue. It may be broader than a Latino issue. I mean, who did Henry B. groom to take his place? Nobody. Who did Henry Cisneros groom to take his place? Nobody.
Lila Cockrell.
Who did?
Get back to his godmother. Yeah.
Who did Frank Tejeda groom to take any of his positions as he left? No one. I mean, it's just, I don't know if it's egos, I don't know if it's, you know, lack of confidence that, you know, we're going to train somebody, they're going to boot us out, or what it is, but we seem to have a real problem in that area with leadership, building leadership and grooming people to take our place. And it's sad. It's sad because then you have these huge gaps, and then they're filled by other people. Not Latinos that come in. Now at NCLR, there's no way you're going to have a non-Latino leading the organization. And I think one of the issues that we're going to fight with is which Latino. Do you put a Cubano in there, Puerto Rican in there, a Mexicano in there? I mean, Raul gets criticized all the time by staff that he is stacking NCLR with Mexicanos.
Well, that's who started the program, and that's who built the program.
And so
there's no reciprocity from the other groups, or do you feel that there is?
No, but you know what, I can't really say, because, you know, and we're all Mexicanos here, and, you know, I really don't deal with a lot of the internal Latino racism that exists, but I know it's out there. And I'm sure it's a difficult balance for Raul in Washington. I mean, we have people from El Salvador, Bolivia, Puerto Rico. I mean, it's like one of each.
But realistically, aren't those numbers insignificant?
Well, it depends on which communities you're in. You mean overall?
In the national community.
In the national community, I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure Mexicanos are way up there compared to the rest of them.
I've covered the questions I wanted to ask you. I'm sure that we could spend another 2 hours on issues and things because NCLR has a long, long history. And many, many activities. We didn't touch any of the programmatic stuff except what you mentioned. Is there anything you want to talk about that you think is important for my grasp of the politics of NCLR as an organization, as a staff-led organization, the leadership role it plays in the national community and at the local level, or of your affiliates? Or anything you want to say about yourself?
Well, actually, I think NCLR is changing right now. I think we're in a mode where we have to change to survive. And I think we have to become performance-based. And we're going to have some very specific deliverables that we're going to have, because that's the way funding sources are going. And funding sources pretty much dictate how things operate. I think we're looking at, and our first one is this revolving loan fund, is activities that generate some income back into the program. Of course, that will only support itself. Well, not even support itself, but support most of itself. But it's a whole different way of doing business. And it's difficult for a lot of the affiliates because they're not used to us playing that role. As a matter of fact, we're working with one now where, it's like, okay, well, we're trying to look at the development and see whether we can go in as an equity partner or whether we can make a low-interest loan. And, the group is pretty incensed about, what do you mean? You want your finger in this? Give us the grant and go away. So it's really a change. With that, there's been changes, at the management level, coming in, and it's tough for some of us. I mean, it's tough for me because I'm into organizational development, and now we're saying, well, we're going to go with the groups that are ready, and those that are not, well, we'll hope that they catch up. I'm not there. I'm with those. Let's go with the groups that are ready, and let's help the ones that are not there get ready to get there. I mean, we talk a lot about institutions, and Latinos really don't have an institution. Somebody tried to tell me it was the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is not a Latino institution. The blacks have the black churches, and those are black institutions. Most of your other institutions are white institutions. So which ones belong to us? And the institutions that belong to us are our community-based organizations. And, I feel very strongly about our need to build those organizations. But when I say build them, I don't mean going in and telling them, I'm Frances Dedan, and I'm from NCLR, and this is what I think you should be doing in your community. Because this is what I want you to do. I mean build those organizations by having those organizations come in and tell us, we live in this community and this is what we think we need, and that we support that. And however we can. Sometimes I think when you become the funder, you get co-opted by who's funding you, and so then you start to put this square peg in a round hole. And as much as we say, do we positively impact Latino families? Do we know those communities? We don't know those communities. The community-based organizations know those communities. And that's who has to tell us what the needs are. And if they make a mistake, they make a mistake. If they identified the wrong needs, they identified the wrong needs. But they need to make those mistakes. They need to realize that they have to go into a different direction and then come back. We can't sit up here, pop into a community for 30 minutes and know what the community needs. And I think that's a real danger. And I think we need to stay grounded with, what our role should be and not cross that line.